Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Hello, Willis.
Hello, Aaron.
So, this week was a red letter week. The full disclosure at our house is, let's see, I got a new tooth on Monday. That was exciting. And so my first world dental problem is over. And we got hot water on Friday. Two solid weeks. American Home Shield still gets a D. We'll give them a D because we actually do have water.
But yeah, it only took them 14 days. You know, that's a strong D.
The really good part is we met Robert Gutierrez of Hot Water. His name of his business is Hot Water Plumbing Hero. And I got to say, he was the Hot Water Plumbing Hero. You can find him actually at Hot Water Plumbing Hero. I believe it's .com. It's not on his card here. But I'm going to post it on the deal for today, but it's 888-482-4287, and they're here in Reading. So if you need hot water, look up Hot Water Plumbing Hero, and Robert will come and solve your problems. And despite American Home Shield's dilly-dallying, he was on them, like on them, to get that done. So it wouldn't have happened as fast without him. So anyway, free advertisement of the week goes to our ability to shower. Yay.
Phew.
Yeah, yeah, it's been spectacular. In our own house, actually. We did shower for the last 2 weeks, just not to scare you too bad, but it was, roving around with a towel and a bar of soap.
Thank you for doing that.
It's like, oh, come on. We did it for you, Alex, even though we're in a different room from you. You could have dodged us. All right. That's all the happiness we have for you. The happiness is now over. We are moving on to the bad news, but I gotta say, timely news. So all we're hearing about right now is, all about gas prices, gas. And I just have been kind of concerned the last couple of weeks. I guess concerned is a nice way of putting it, that all of the things that are going on with Iran and all that, everybody will say, oh, that's why the gas prices are going up. Out here on the West Coast, that is not why. And if this is the first time you're kind of hearing that that's the case, we have set up a kind of a subdomain, or it just goes directly to this issue, and it's gascrisis.org. It is on the We the People Radio website, but it's gascrisis.org. Gets you there fast. And we'll take you to our three guests for today. Professor Michael Miché. He is at USC. He is the associate professor of the practice of management and organization. And his bio and all of his information is online. And I think he has limited time, so we're not going to fool around with that. But he's been at USC since 1997. So he didn't just get there and he didn't just start looking at this. And Stan Ellis is an assemblyman in the California legislature. That is his part-time gig, I guess. Maybe we call it that. But he is a farmer, a local businessman, and he is really an oil and gas expert. He also, he just runs a whole bunch of different companies and, runs a quantum physics lab as well. So we get a lot of good information from him. And our third player is Mike Ariza. He is was a technician, a plant operator at, Valero. So, all three of these guys come from different vantage points, and this is the fifth in a series that we have done with them. I'm sure it will not be the last program, but we have all of the shows posted. We have all of the papers that have been written, the letters that we're going to talk about from Valero or from Chevron and PBF. They are all online. If you go to gascrisis.org, you can click on all of that, read it for yourself. There are a lot of really excellent media articles and articles from USC that Professor Miché has there. We have so much information. I had to do a couple of drop-down. I had to put all the videos on one page because they were starting to get kind of voluminous. And the gas crisis media reports are on another page. It's all linked up. So I hope you will go and get educated. And now, I don't know who's starting off today. Professor, are you the one with the limited time frame? If so, we'll kick it to you. Unless somebody else has a better idea. Like anyone who's...
I didn't hear the professor on, but, you know...
Oh, okay.
You made a real error. You made a great comment. Well, is the professor there?
Well, I guess when he gets on there, he can pipe up. But
yeah.
Stan...
Yeah.
So yes.
Anyway, yeah, Eric, you made a great comment. The Iran conflict has nothing to do whatsoever with our price of oil and gas in what's going on here. You know, it's just very... This could be fixed so easily. Literally, get CARB to stand down, get the cap and trade to go away, and you have businesses that now want to stay and produce. I'm concerned we're going to lose more refineries. I'm concerned that we're not going to have any place to ship our crude. And with that insecurity now, you have producers reluctant to even go out and spend $1 million on a well to produce. And because where are you going to send it?
Yeah.
So we're in quite a conundrum here right now.
So, I don't know when you want to get into the PBF and the Chevron letters, but I don't. I'm sure that none of that made the national news, of course.
Yeah, of course. Of course not. Because you know, we're California, we're an island. And it's just so frustrating that I think we're going to need federal intervention. Because obviously the state isn't going to do anything about it.
Yeah, isn't it terrifying that the federal government will come and save us?
Yeah, that's pretty sad, isn't it?
I mean, it just seems kind of crazy, actually.
I'm telling you, the thing. Go ahead.
Hello, everybody. Professor Mishay finally joined us here. I finally made it.
Nice. Are you pushed for time?
A little bit, but I always have time for you, Aaron.
Because
you play great rock music, so hey,
I have new songs for you today.
Okay.
You know, as it turns out, those breakup songs, the bad girlfriend songs, also kind of fit with this gas thing.
Yeah, well, yeah, they do, and they align a lot with a lot of memories in my life too. So
there you go.
No, we have made the national news. PBF letter and Chevron letters have made the national news. They were on Fox. They were on Fox the last few days. They were on Fox in the morning. Fox Business Show, not necessarily Fox News.
They were on the news feed this morning. News. We heard it this morning.
On there. Yeah, and then, you know, I think the problem with, I don't think there's a problem with the federal government coming in here to fix this because that's what we've been calling for. I mean, you know, when you take a look at California, I think I call it the three N's, you know, incompetent, incapable, and insensitive. And so, you know, they're oblivious to the impact of these price increases on people that are marginalized, aren't fixed incomes, are working two or three jobs, all in the name of climate change and a better environment, which we're all for. But let's face it, California accounts for less than 1% of total greenhouse emissions globally. I mean, really, putting the economy through this type of shock is questionable action.
Yeah, and so for people that were not watching the Business Channel, explain to them what are, you know, spoiler alert, some of the messaging of PBF Energy and what that means to us.
Yeah, I'll take a shot at that, and then Mike and Stan can fill it in with all the color. But in a sense, what's happened, so in California, if a refinery wants to shut down, it has to issue a one-year letter, notice of 1 year, okay, which says, okay, a year from now, I'm going to shut my refinery down. What PBF and Chevron did was issue a courtesy letter and and said, look, if these CARB amendments, the low carbon fuel standard, actually go through, they will have a detrimental impact on the California consumer because the price of gas could go up by at least a dollar a gallon, if not more. I think UC Davis, a public school, came up with $1.21 a gallon. So they said if these proposed amendments go through, we will be in a position where we are not profitable. It will cost us so much money to comply with these amendments, with the proposed amendments for CARB, that it just simply isn't profitable for us to operate, along with pretty much any other refiner in the state. And so basically what they did, and they were very clear about it, they put the state on notice, and they said, if you pass this, then we may, I'll emphasize the word,
issue a letter.
We may issue that one-year letter saying we are exiting the state. And when you're looking at a refinery such as Chevron and PBF, if we lose those three refineries, honestly, the game is over, because that's the majority of refining capacity in the state of California as it exists today. So it's a serious notice that both these refiners have provided.
Well, and there are a lot of them that still think that that Valero is up.
It's down, and we've said it's down, and we've talked about that. But I think Mike Ariza is going to give us some really good insight into that. So Mike, why don't you sort of tell us, you know, what your intelligence and your sources have told you?
Yeah, Roger that. One thing on the professor's point about the intent of Chevron and PBF. I was watching an interview with Jenny at ABC, and she asked, you know, did the good reporter thing, and asked Mr. Walls with Chevron just flat out. So is Chevron really looking to close it down? And you know, normally when they're answering questions like that, it'll be, well, you know, we're kind of looking at this and that. He just came right back to her and said, yes. If things don't change, we're shutting down. Okay, there was no dancing around it. It was a straight up, we're done. And if they go down, we lose 86% of our crude oil capacity. Since 2023, 86% of our crude oil producing capacity is offline. Now with Valero, what's going on with Valero? They're shut down. They've been just shut down, just as we predicted in October when they canceled the crude oil contract, that they were going to shut down. In January, in our meeting, I'd even mentioned December, and the professor said, you know, probably January. So it happened in January. They pulled feed from the crude unit in January. A couple days later, the professor got a confirmation that thermal imaging was showing the refinery's cold. And then on the 4th of February, I get a message from my friend Randy saying that the cat and the coker were down. So that means the whole refinery's down. So what they're at right now, is this is the last week the refinery is fully staffed. A lot of people left, like 30 people left when they announced they were going. Now they're on their last week of full staffing. So by the time you get into April, which is, and units are open right now. It's down, tanks, a lot of tamils, all the tanks are emptied, and units are open for clearing, basically for mothballing. And by the time we get to April, which is what the media keeps reporting, you know, we're going to shut down in April. By the time we get to April, the refinery is only going to have 20 people, where it used to have almost 500. And the only units that will be operating is the wastewater treating plant, the tank farm, and then the dock. Because what they're doing right now is they're working to see what they can do to convert the refinery into a terminal.
And a terminal would just be receiving and storing?
Receiving, storing, and then using their equipment that they use now to ship out to Kinder Morgan, out to the main distributing hub on the pipelines out in the Bay Area, and then going from there. But, you know, when I went to San Francisco, picked up my wife a couple weeks ago, there were so many tankers parked out in the bay. It was ridiculous. But yeah, you lost about 400 jobs directly associated with the refinery gone, and the vulnerability now. We'll be importing. If those refineries go down, and another thing my friend told me yesterday when I was talking to him is Valero, just, they're pissed. They're absolutely pissed. They are so disgusted with this state. That's, you know, you get that from the middle management passed down from the upper management. They're just totally disgusted with California. And I got a feeling, and the professor might speak a little more to this, but the Valero Wilmington refinery, I think along with these PBF refineries and the two Chevron refineries, you very well may next year or not too soon afterwards see Valero shut down its Wilmington refinery. Then we'll be down to one.
And so let's take a really quick break on that super unpleasant note. And we'll be right back with the fellas. You can find all this and all the backstory and the things we're referencing at gascrisis.org, but you are listening to We the People Radio, and you can find that site at wethepeopleradio.us.
No further exemption. Just a big red goodbye and lipstick on the wall. Goodbye says it all. No long explanation. No reconciliation. No let's talk it over number I can call. Goodbye says it all. Who's gonna tell you things aren't so great? You can't go on thinking nothing's wrong. Gonna drive you home tonight.
Great song.
Well, no one, because there's no gas. Mm-hmm. So goodbye says it all.
Got a scooter.
I like the goodbye written in lipstick on the mirror. I was thinking, you know, Chevron might want to do that.
Yeah, I've seen that a few times.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny, but like all the bad girlfriend songs were like, oh man, that'll work. That's a good one. Oh, I don't listen to the radio anymore for music. I listen for you guys. Like, does this make sense?
Well, we appreciate that. But think about this for a second, right? You have Valero, which is the surviving refineries down here in Southern California, and their CEO stated publicly and in Wall Street analyst meetings that they intend to operate that refinery through the end of the decade. So it's already halfway through 2026. You're looking at 27, 28, and 29. But I think that the interesting aspect of that refinery is, if I'm not mistaken, it's up for a major turnaround in the next year or two. And so you have to ask the question, since they've already written off over $1.1 billion of assets in the state of California, that refinery is off the balance sheet right now. Would it make sense, would it make prudent economic sense or financial sense for them to do a turnaround and invest hundreds of millions of dollars only to operate it for another 1 or 2 years? And so one has to take that into consideration when we do our planning for production of gasoline and jet fuels in the state of California.
Jeez.
Sorry, my phone call dropped real quick. I just wanted one more thing on Valero in particular. Okay, Valero, to get rid of sulfur dioxide and particulate emissions that had been going out the main stack for 4 decades with no problem, they spent $700 million on two brand new furnaces. They ripped out the old ones, some precipitators, a waste gas boiler, an MEA scrubbing system to get rid of that slippage of SO2 and particulates. So they took, you know, basically nothing was going to the atmosphere at all. So, you know, you got a company, they invested, and again, they don't own crude oil. They invested $700 million to comply with what the state wanted them to do as far as these emissions were concerned. And then they got hammered with that fine on the hydrogen generation unit, which is the cleanest unit in any refinery. So, Those are some of the reasons why Valero is just basically disgusted with the state, and San Antonio said, okay, we're done.
Well, you kind of have to. So do these guys, Chevron and PBF, so between the two of them, they're talking about four of the seven remaining refineries. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Okay, so let's say the California Air Resources Board comes back and says, we've decided we're not going to change. Before I go down the road, though, so the cap and trade fees or tax or whatever you want to call it that they have to pay, the main problem is that the companies that are bringing these fuels, like by ship from wherever, India, China, Russia, wherever it's coming from, they don't pay them. Only the guys refining here in the state. So it's just a massively unfair, I don't know if it's considered a tax or a fee, probably a fee, I guess is what they would call it. But what are the odds that they'll back off on that? What do you guys think?
Well, I think from the state legislator standpoint, I've been advocating for this for a while now. Obviously, you know, Professor Mish and Mike Ariza and myself brought this to the attention of the public about 6-8 months ago. And the answer is you have to give them some monetary relief because they're spending so much money on abatement equipment and emissions equipment. And now you put a tax on what they put out in CO2 and carbon monoxide and nitrous oxide. And so all of a sudden, it's just compounded into hundreds of millions of dollars a year per refinery. It's just impossible to operate. And furthermore, it's not just the refineries that are paying. It's anybody that has any types of emissions, cement plants, all types of industry that burn natural gas that are falling into this cap and trade, it's killing California. And it's a bad, bad program. And I'm telling you, all of this crisis right now is self-induced. There is no one to blame other than our own legislature and our own administration. Everybody wants to try to blame Trump. I hear it on the legislative floor every day. Well, this is Trump's fault. No, this is our fault in the state of California. There is no one to blame but ourselves. And the only way we're going to fix it is to get less regulation and get rid of cap and trade for the long term. If that happens, you would actually attract business. But nobody, everybody wants to leave for obvious reasons. It's self-induced. I'm sorry, Mike Ariza said that everybody's pissed. Well, you think they're pissed up there? You ought to see Kern County, where we were the fifth largest oil producing county in the nation. We're upset. Our industry, our livelihood, thousands and thousands of jobs are at risk, and that goes to our GDP. So we're killing ourselves. Sorry, I'm a little fired up right now.
No. The good news is somebody in the legislature's fired up.
Yeah, it's good to see my friend Stan Ellis fired up, because Stan's a smart man and he's got the best interest of the state in mind and in his heart. But let's carry the math out a little bit further, because I know Stan loves math. He was a math major, brilliant, by the way. Let's just say, for example, two points I want to make. First one's an easy one. A study done by University of California, I think it was the Center of Public Policy and Labor, calculated the impact of Benicia on Contra Costa County. And the impact, the economic impact, both direct and indirect, because we're economists, we count for both, is somewhere around $972 million a year in lost economic activity and revenue. Almost $1 billion. A third of that is direct, two-thirds of that would be indirect. And so the question then becomes, when you lose these refineries and you lose $1 billion a year in economic activity, how will you make that up?
Exactly.
How are you going to make that up? And nobody, as far as I know, no one in the legislature stand. I mean, I don't want to speak for you, but as far as I know, nobody has come forward in the legislature and said, "Oh, let's, you know, if we build a battery plant, we'll replace that in a heartbeat." Yeah, no, I haven't heard that.
And that money that they're taking in, obviously they're spending it all. Either I don't know what they spend it on, wages, programs, whatever. But if they're not going to make that up, there's going to be some real hardship in that county. That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. You know, in Benicia itself, we know the city's losing 20% of its tax base as a result of that closing. How's Benicia? You know, with no disrespect to Benicia, I've been there, and it's not a, you know, it's probably not a place where a lot of people, you know, are sitting in Kansas or Texas and say, gee, when I move to California,
I want to move to Benicia. Yeah.
Right, you know, it just doesn't.
It's kind of windy
it
there.
It doesn't rise to that. Yeah, it is windy. And then the second thing. So let's play out the PBF and Chevron letters a little bit, okay? And let's just say that indeed Chevron and PBF pulled the plug. I'm not saying they are, and I have no inside information. I'm just playing devil's advocate and creating a scenario. If indeed they did that, and they did it, say, by the year 2029, 2030 at the latest, I would think 2029, even earlier, 2028 maybe, we would lose from 2023 to 2000, whenever they pull the plug, 76% of all in-state refinery capacity.
Jeez.
76%. And that'll be an absolute impossibility to import that much gasoline, given the current infrastructure. So, you know, if indeed these refiners do pull out, irrespective of, you know, what somebody in an ivory tower might be saying up in Sacramento, particularly in the CARB offices, we will be losing 76% of production since 2023. And we all know that gasoline consumption is not going to come down by 76%.
No.
It's coming down at about 2%, slightly less than 2% a year. The 2025 numbers just came out from the California Department of Taxation and Franchise Fees and Administration, right? So it was a modest decline of like 1.7% from 2024. So, you know, we're not seeing these revolutionary declines. And think about that. If we lose 76% of refinery capacity, it is no way the state can import that amount of fuel unless it completes the pipeline by 2029 coming in from Arizona, which we all know is a noble aspiration, but probably will face an endless amount of lawsuits and litigation. Yeah, so... So as Stan points out, and I will be making that, releasing that number on the 18th of March, what the potential impact might be on California GDP with the loss of these refineries.
Well, and also 76%, that's a number you're not going to make up by cutting back on your usage and, you know, conserving. You can't do 76% that way. We've got to produce it, or there are going to be hardships. There's going to be, I mean, we had, what, shortages in the 80s? Is that when they had gas lines and whatnot? It'll make that look like a picnic.
Oh, yeah. But here's the difference, and Mike Ariza brought this out a few times in conversations, and you know, if I can paraphrase it, what the difference there was that we were short oil, but we weren't short refinery capacity. So when the oil started to flow again, we had plenty of capacity to make gasoline and recover relatively quickly. But what we have now, though, is even if we had the oil, if we lose these refineries, doesn't really matter.
Has anybody talked about getting rid of this summer blend, winter blend, California blend? I mean, that would really relieve a lot, wouldn't it, if we burn the same fuel as everybody else?
Well, okay, so you need to bifurcate that because you have the summer blend, you have the blends, the seasonal blends, and then you have the low carbon fuel standard for California special blend, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the summer and the winter blends, those are federal standards,
okay.
And they do have a positive impact on emissions and the quality of air and things like that due to ambient temperatures and barometric pressure and things like that. So the idea of having a winter and summer blend is actually a pretty good idea. The question you now have is that to what extent, given modern engines, remember this California fuel standard goes back to 1968 or something like that. Okay?
Right.
Given modern engines, modern drivetrains, the emission control that are on these cars today, does it make sense to have a low-carbon fuel standard that's completely different than the rest of the nation? That's question number one. And then question number two is, what is the marginal rate of return by changing that standard? So in other words, if indeed you're going to increase the price of gas by at least $1.20 and run the risk of running these refineries out of the state of California, in which case gas will be $20 a gallon. Does it make sense to do that? In the sense of, are you increasing the quality of air in the environment by a comparable, if not greater, amount? And I think most people will say the answer is, well, probably not. So a reasonable course of action, given where California is at, would be for the president and the EPA to step in and say, well, we'll suspend the low-carbon fuel standards and just adopt the uniform reformulated gasoline standard that's used across the country. That would open up refineries and supplies to California that have been closed off to the state because they don't make the low-carbon fuel
right.
standard. So that's why you have to go to Asia and India and all those places.
Well, Professor, and this actually question is for the professor and Mike Ariza. I am ignorant as to, you know, we're bringing in this product from India and South Korea and this finished product. Did those refineries spend billions of dollars to meet low carbon fuel standards? So what are we getting when we import these products? And in fact, are we meeting specs? And maybe we are, and maybe we aren't, but I don't know. So why would they spend billions of dollars to meet California specs? I think there's a responsibility here to look into that, and I'm going to take that action item. Professor, do you, Mike?
That's a great point.
I think you should. I think that's a very significant point.
It's a valid point. Yep.
Yeah, because these guys are basically just gross polluters, and
that's the thing that's so ironic about. About this cap and investment is you're penalizing refineries to the point where they're going to leave, but you're not charging these people that are the gross polluters. It's so hypocritical.
Well, we're literally outsourcing our schmutz at this point.
Yeah.
I don't have a song for that, darn it. We have to take a really quick break. I wish I had a good schmutz song. If anybody knows one, I want you to email it to me. But we'll be right back. So we're talking about the gas crisis in California. And before we close out this topic today, we're going to explain why you care about it, even if you don't live here. Because all the people who listen to this who don't live here are like, well, you guys are idiots. Why are you still there? But thing is, if we don't stay here and fight, it's kind of coming for you. As with all the bad things that start out here. It's like a contagion.
True.
The contagion. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Yes, these are some good times, so take a good look around. You may not know it now, but you're gonna miss this. You're gonna miss this. Yeah. Miss it.
cat was cold. He said, don't call us, child, we'll call you. I said, you got my number? He said, yeah, I got it. We walked in the door.
That's the next PBF letter. They're going to just send a musical clip. I shouldn't joke about this, but it's like you almost got
to have to.
Yeah, you do.
I mean, when you look at some of these decisions, they defy logic. And so at a certain point, you have to have a sense of humor.
Oh, yeah.
As dark as that might be and as sad as that might be, but I mean, at a certain point, they do define logic. And as Stan said, these are self-created. And as I said in my March, last year, I wrote that report on price gouging. And I said, you know, these are all self-inflicted wounds that the state has created for itself.
So we plumbed Stan on this one a while back, that the people in the legislature will say, privately, that this is a problem, but publicly won't go against the governor or their party. And so in a deal like that, no one in this state, I'm guessing here, but no one in this state is going to rein in the California Air Resources Board.
That'd be a pariah.
Is that right?
You're right.
That's sad because I think of anything, you know, it's time for a DOGE approach to California, some of these California agencies. I think a strong governor, whoever that might be, should come in and take a very, very serious look at pretty much every agency, including CARB in particular and the CEC in particular, and say, what's the cost and what's the benefit to the California taxpayers? What are they truly, truly doing? And one of the things we know that CARB doesn't do is when they pass regulations, they don't do an assessment of the cost of that regulation
of the damage.
So no,
that's right, damage.
So I know that there's a bill pending on that, that's going to be presented before the legislature. But it only seems reasonable that if you're going to pass a piece of legislation, that you should at least do the cost benefit study. And tell the legislature, okay, this is the benefit, this is the cost, and this is the cost to the general public, and this is what it will do to inflation. This is what it could do to GDP. I think these are just reasonable things to ask. But CARB has consistently denied having the having the role to do that, and they have hidden behind, and I've seen this in testimony. It's impossible to predict the market; it's too volatile. Well, then if you don't want to predict it, then hire three or four different universities and let academics come up with it and present their findings to the legislature.
I've requested an audit of CARB, and then on the note of my colleagues, sincerely some really good people, I'm down in the people bashing business, and I'm trying to stay non-political here. However, and I will tell you that I'm in conversations with the CEC, great folks, caught between a rock and a hard spot. They want to do something, but they're, again, caught between an administration that won't help them. They have some of the answers, but they're in a tough spot. So ultimately, it does get political. From where I'm sitting, let's fix the problem, because we're problem solvers. The Problem Solvers Caucus that I'm on all see the same thing. They want to help. It's a nonpartisan group of folks. They've made recommendations, but we don't see any action. All we've seen is lip service, which is typical since I've been in the legislature. All we get is lip service. It's really, really frustrating. But I would tell you that my colleagues on the other side of the aisle see the problem. They acknowledge the problem. And some of them are trying to do something about it. So,
what would that look like? What does that look like? So, if they're trying to do something about it, but they're not really willing to speak out about it publicly, how would that even happen?
Well, they're letting me carry the... They're letting me be the bad guy.
Our friend Stan. Our friend Stan will help us.
Yeah, so there... And I've built some great relationships there. And so... And it is about... It's like business. You build relationships. Sure. I've done the same thing there. And so I have some support. And so I'm fighting... I'm going to audit CARB. There's some legislation about CARB, making sure that they do an analysis on how does this, what is the cost and the impact of the public. So there are some, and like on CEQA reform, a lot of my colleagues now are fired up about CEQA and getting them, in check and not having the stringency of CEQA. So they're seeing it, but the problem is it's not fast enough.
Yeah.
We need to do something now.
Right.
We can't wait for legislature and bureaucracy and government to fix the problem. But I'm telling you, with the stroke of a pen, our governor could fix the cap and trade problem, and he could fix CARB.
So
now we could
do it now.
So what
we could,
what could he do? What exactly would that look like? What does that look like?
I think it would be executive action, but I'm not sure because I'm not that much of a politician yet, trying to be the public servant. I don't know what that looks like.
Okay.
The governor could invoke executive action. He could, for example, with the stroke of a pen, probably reduce the state excise tax, which is 62 cents a gallon. He could reduce that overnight. It's the highest in the country.
Well, that's right. I forgot about that.
He could take 30 cents off of that just by saying... or suspend it. I'm not suggesting we eliminate it. I'm suggesting we suspend it for a period of time until we have more clarity on these gasoline prices and the supply. You could do that. You could also begin to address cap and trade. There are a number of studies, and the cap and trade numbers are all over the place, and you can't get them from CARB. So, one study, I think that was from University of California, Davis, I think had it at $1.21 a gallon. University of Pennsylvania had it up to $1.48 a gallon. I had it at 68 cents a gallon. I guess I'm the most conservative. So we're not really sure what this cap and invest program actually is going to cost, but we all agree it's going to cost a lot more. So whether it's 68 cents a gallon or $1.48 a gallon, it's going to cost a lot more. Well, the governor could say, you know what, maybe we're rushing that program. But, look, he's not going to do that because, well, he needs to fund the high-speed rail project. 25% of cap and trade goes into that thing. So, there's conflicting objectives here. But I think people like Stan and your show are perhaps bringing those conflicting objectives out into the public domain, and perhaps people are beginning to appreciate them a little bit more.
Yeah.
And let's throw this out there with gasoline, okay? If Mr. Walsh from Chevron said that they supply 60% of SFO, Oakland, 60% of SFO, and they supply jet fuel to all the other airports, San Jose, Oakland, SAC, and the PBF said they supply 40% of San Francisco's fuel. So those two shut down, zero fuel for SFO, and more than likely zero fuel for Oakland, Sacramento, San Jose, Travis, McClellan, all these different bases, no fuel. And once those two are down in the Bay Area, there are no refineries in Northern California that will be producing jet fuel, none. They're gone. And then same thing down south. I think El Segundo and the PBF refinery down there supply something like 60 or 70% of the fuel for LAX. So these are other things. So we got the big threat to the military with no jet fuel, very, very little jet fuel production at all in the state. And then the diesel production is going to crater. They're going to have a hard time with all the problems with trucks right now getting food into cities. Cities have 3 or 4 days of food supply. That's all they have. You're going to have a hard time getting food into cities to keep feeding people. This is the real danger we're in. This is what we, as a team, me and the professor and Stan, we had all, you kept speaking about this. Besides storms and other things that can affect California world event, and then California, the condition California has got itself in to where it can't recover. So we're in a real dangerous situation. And I mean, I watched that interview with Mr. Waltz. He wasn't messing around. He just flat out, no, we're ready to leave. We're done.
So let me bring up a point that we don't mention very much. You know, every one of us want clean air, and every one of us want clean water and a nice clean environment. But what has happened here is the environmental groups that are so happy to sue about anything and funded from covert operations like China and Soros and all these companies, they come in and they sue and they sue and they sue and they sue. So what it's done, it's driven our present administration to a point where all they want to do is talk about greenhouse gas and a reduction of greenhouse gas and a greenhouse gas agenda. What it's done, I hate pointing fingers and blame, but if there's someone responsible, it's our environmental groups that are extremists and they're terrorists, and they have driven our state oil and gas sector into a dire strait. And then, of course, guess what? We have an administration that buys off and wants to satisfy them, doesn't want to go against them, and every time you turn around, we have a lawsuit. So ultimately, if you go right to the root of the problem, that's where it starts. But it is our fault administratively as a legislative body to keep that in check, and we have not. Sorry.
I think the part that's actually kind of funny and crazy all at once is Tom Steyer running for governor. His ad, I don't catch ads all that much, but I did catch and I backed up. I backed up and watched it again, and it's like, did he just say that he has, like, I don't know, I don't think he said single-handedly, that's what I heard in my snarky head, was that he had, like, single-handedly crushed big oil, and I thought, oh, when people are paying $10 a gallon, I'm thinking his gubernatorial odds are going to go way down. I mean, that's stupid. They're still bragging about that.
Yeah, they shouldn't be driving an electric car that's 122,000 miles neutral before it comes carbon neutral. They shouldn't ride a bicycle because of the rubber tires and the butyl styrene. They shouldn't brush their teeth because of the glycol. It's like these people are just hypocrites.
Oh, totally. Yep. Totally.
Yeah, and there, I mean, there's an element of mental illness to this that really can't be avoided because you can't explain logically why they're not taking care of it. I mean, when they're talking about this, Stan, in the legislature, and they see this giant bullet coming for the public, is this like ducks? They look fine on top, but their feet are moving really fast under the water, or is the bottom the same as the top? Like, they're just coasting along.
There are a few of my colleagues that are very serious and are actually signing on. The folks from the big, huge metropolitan areas that are greenies and greenie-driven are, on the surface, like you say, will talk to me, but when it comes to the really getting and digging in, they back away really fast.
And their constituents are going to be the ones that are suffering the most.
They want to blame it on affordability, and they want to blame it on Trump. Nobody will stand accountable. I'm accountable. I'm in there. We should all be held accountable. But they don't want to be held accountable for any crisis. They want always, if you listen, they always shift the blame. There's always blame. Let's shift the blame.
Yeah.
I'm accountable. I stand accountable for my constituents. And I have many, many people come up to me in the oil and gas sector because I was in it, and a lot of my friends, and they're ranting and raving and said, why can't you do something? Why can't you do something? I'm trying. I'm working as hard as I can to try to make something happen in the state legislature.
I don't know how they can look at everybody and realize that this is coming and just, I don't know, let it slide.
Well,
it's crazy,
Aaron,
to me.
They would rather stand up in session and do a resolution on Butterfly Day and Rice Day,
yeah,
and all these other things that, and you know, Friday, Thursday.
Okay, hold that thought. Tell us on the backside of the news. We will be right back.
Okay.
You're listening to We the People. Okay. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us. Had that in the hopper for Stan.
Let's get some blame going.
Let's
out there.
Get that blame working. Oh my gosh! So this is the second half of We the People Radio here on March 8th, 2026, and free advertising of the week goes out to our new best friend Robert Gutierrez at Hot Water Plumbing Hero. Their website is hotwaterplumbinghero.com. They're here in Reading. And, yes, if you hit critical mass and can't take a shower because your hot water heater is broken and your home warranty company is run by imbeciles, Robert can save you. We can testify to that. We even took a picture of him with our hot water heater just to prove it happened. Oh, my gosh. So, we are here with Professor Miche and Stan Ellis and Mike Ariza, and we're making a thing out of this gas deal. If they ever fix the problem, I'll be sad in a way because, you know, our cast of characters will go away. But it's been really enjoyable working with these guys because between the three of them, they've got this whole issue pretty much covered from every vantage point. And if you are just, I don't know, waking up to this and you're thinking, oh, well, they'll just bring in train cars or they'll just have more ships or we'll just get trucks to bring it or blah, blah, blah. Yeah, that's not happening. Bottom line, short answer is that's not happening. So listen to the previous programs. Read the stuff that's on the site. You can get to it swiftly at gascrisis.org. And now back to Stan.
Before we go back to Stan, I would like to go back to something you mentioned earlier.
Oh, we're going to go back to back to back, Stan?
Yeah, we're going to go back to back. The gasoline that we're going to bring in from India, you said, you know, what's the chances that they spent $700 million upgrading their refinery to make California-compliant gasoline? Who's going to test the fuel that comes from India to make sure it is California compliant? And you know, is there an agency assigned to doing that? And if there is, are they actually going to test all this fuel that comes in?
Well, I would think that falls under CARB.
Yeah.
And that's one of the questions I'm going to have for them. Are you testing, and how often are you testing? And do you test every ship? Do you test every truckload? I want to understand the protocol. So when I get back to Sacramento next week, that's going to be one of my questions to CARB. I'm going to write them a letter.
Yeah, I think that's very prudent because you know good and well, once that starts flowing, that's just one of those things that's going to get just quietly swept under the rug, and there won't be any report that we can read or tests that we can read, test results. They'll turn their back on that because it's solving the problem.
The only problem is, what if it is? The question I've been asking myself, what if it is, doesn't meet CARB standards? What are they going to do, stop bringing it in? Now we've even got a bigger crisis?
Exactly.
So we have to be a little careful there.
Well, yeah, we got to be careful, but I think if we can, you know, bring this up now before our refineries close, I think it'd be pretty easy to check to see if India's refineries are compliant.
Yeah, our refineries are compliant. What about what they're bringing in? I agree with you. So I'm going to write a letter on Monday to CARB.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think somebody needs to be over in India checking out their refinery to make sure that they're putting out California-compliant gasoline, because that's
all we care about, well, because that's going to change the world.
Well, I think that, first of all, it's a brilliant idea, and it needs to be done. And then secondly, if you're going to send anybody over to India to check it out, then I think you ought to put in the same type of air particulate collection devices.
Absolutely.
That you have around California refineries. I think those should be installed around Indian refineries, and they should be made to comply to the same California standards that a California refinery has to comply to.
Right.
So if CARB makes an announcement where, the estimated cost of compliance is, let's say, $300 million, those refineries around the world should be held to the same standard. They need to incur that $300 million investment, and CARB needs to verify that.
Right.
If indeed they are serious about climate change and the environment.
And I
wait a minute. Now you're driving up the price of gas for us. There, you know, golly, we're going to pay more for gas because we're going to hold them to the same standard we have.
I think if you try to hold them to the same standards, they'll just sell their gas somewhere else. They don't need California. I mean,
well, of course not. They don't need California. California is just a market for them. They're going to move
on.
But the point is one of consistency and hypocrisy.
Exactly. And if they can't prove that this gas is compliant or as the same quality as what we make over here, then they need to lay off our refineries so we can make our own.
Well, I'm kind of curious, too. So since we have taken, the CO2 is no longer considered a pollutant because that was always ridiculous, doesn't that sort of cut the legs out from under them, or are we just going to pretend that didn't happen since it was done by Orange Man Bad?
No, there's other contaminants in these emissions that I think bear scrutiny and inspection and things like that. But also, I think too, when you begin to look at these offshore refineries, it's not just the global emissions, but you also have things like worker standards, worker safety, human rights, things like that. So, for example, we're importing a lot of gasoline from India right now. And India is the second largest contributor to greenhouse gases, or third largest in the world right now. Certainly greater upward tick in terms of more greenhouse gases are emitted in India in growth than the United States. So I think, somebody needs to sit down and look at this coherently in a very meaningful and total manner. And so perhaps some of the legislation that Stan's talking about would at least get us somewhere along that pathway. It's clearly needed.
So a real pragmatic solution again, because I've been in science, and you're always solving problems. Real simple. This is really, really simple. We stop funding on the high-speed rail, and we put it in water infrastructure. And we grow more crops, and we have all the CO2 sequestration we need. And guess what? We can bring in more industry because we're all green. Everything you plant green needs CO2. So we just fix the big circle that we need, and it's just really simple. But nobody wants to listen because of all the money we're putting in high-speed rail.
And that's going so well.
Yeah. Well, one of the things you wrote about, too, Aaron, on your email, I'm hearing a lot. You know, when Valero went down, we were all concerned that we were at critical path with our ability to offload tankers. And we know when Valero went down, prices started to go up. And it was specifically because Valero shut down. But now you're seeing a lot. They're blaming it on Trump. So I just kind of wanted to bring that out, too, that the shutdown of Valero did start to have the effect that we had anticipated it was going to have.
Yeah, I look at that, and it's the timing is such. And then they were saying the other thing that was on there was the cutback on oil to China, a fairly decent percentage. What does that do for what's being brought in here? Have you looked at that?
Well, they're going to, whether they want the adversary or not, they're going to protect their own. They have a decent amount of oil supply on hand, but, you know, they get their supply cut off, which it has been right now, like 40% of it. And they're exporting fuel. My understanding is just yesterday, the day before, Beijing basically gave a decree for all of their refineries to stop exporting gasoline and diesel fuel.
Oh, yeah, I was kind of curious about that. Well, that'll work out well for us.
Yeah, so to kind of put it in context for the listeners on this, if I can, Aaron.
Yes, please.
China bought, they were the largest consumer of Iranian oil. So they acquired about 90% of Iranian production. So 90% of what Iran produced for oil went to China. China was also one of the largest consumer, if not the largest consumer, of Venezuelan oil. So what happened in there was China has loaned Venezuela approximately $54 billion, and the payment for that $54 billion was done in oil. So oil for dollars. And the thing there was China was getting an incredible favorable rate. They were getting this oil at somewhere below 40% under Brent prices, and so under the new program that was done by President Trump, China's still being repaid for loans, except the oil's not being sold at 40% below Brent prices. It's being sold at market, and so when the president talks about it's a better deal for the Venezuelan people, that's why it's a better deal. They're getting a fair price for their oil versus under the old regime, they were not getting a fair price for the oil. So this puts China in a sort of an interesting situation as to where they're going to get their oil. Now, one of the refineries was just hit in Iran by the Israelis last night. And the question is, will the terminal tanker be hit, the maritime terminal tanker, also be a target of opportunity for the Israelis or the United States? This has a real detrimental impact on China. So China now is more dependent on Russian oil than it's ever been before.
Well, and also I heard that pretty much all the oil that goes to India comes from Russia. So, again, we'll be buying gasoline from India that's being made with Russian oil. That makes a lot of sense.
Well, I understand it's 40%.
It's 40%, yeah.
So think about that for a minute. If all of a sudden Russia needs more oil, they're going to cut off India. Guess what? That cuts off supply to us, indirectly, with gas and diesel. How about them apples?
Yeah.
Well, it has it's all of the things that we've been warning about, possibilities that can directly affect us and just choke this state, they're starting to occur. You know, we had a list of about 8 or 9 things, and a few of those are occurring. We warned about this. It's not a surprise to us. We saw this as a possibility, and here it is before us right now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so on that note, you know, really kudos to Professor Mish and Mike Ariza, because, you know, we've all been in the industry. They did a great job foreseeing this. But I said this morning, this is all talk. And what's really important, Aaron, is that you're bringing this to light to a lot of people that helped it, to help them understand this crisis that we're going to be in shortly in oil and gas. So, and so I have to, as do everything I can in my power to do something instead of just talk about it. I'm tired of talking about it. I'm tired of being reactive. But, again, kudos to you for bringing up this awareness to everyone. So thank you.
Yeah. I mean, we really appreciate you guys' expertise. And you know, the bad part is with things like this, you wind up with a bunch of people spouting off. Like, there was a video that I got, and the 2 seconds into it, the guy's saying, well, you know, Valero was slated to go down. And it's like, okay, well, you're already not credible because you're behind the curve. So there's all this crazy information coming out there with people's opinions. And I think that's where the three of you are the most valuable, because you're really drilled into this, and it's factual. So when people are, maybe after the break, we could touch again on why the seemingly obvious simple solutions are not available. We don't have to, you know, belabor it, but the idea that there are no pipelines coming into California, you know, that the solution is not as easy as it might seem, because there are a lot of people that are like, oh, well, you know, we'll just bring it in from Texas, you know. Well, we'll just get it from Venezuela. It's like, yeah, okay.
How about we just drill our own?
Yeah. What a great idea. Gee, Bill. Let's put Bill in charge.
Well, like Bill, Dan's saying about you, Aaron, and you bringing the awareness of this out and creating that domain so people have something they can reference to look at what's the real story here.
Yeah, go look at the facts.
What's really going on.
Yeah, I really appreciate, and you guys' 10-page paper, I've labeled it as the comprehensive analysis, and it's kind of everywhere. It's on all the pages. And I really do hope people look at that, even if all you do is skim and read the parts that are in red. You've made it, like, as easy as possible, you know. You don't have to take a college course, although if I was going to take a college course and I lived by USC, I'd get in the professor's class because I think it would be super interesting. But,
Aaron, you're always welcome to come visit anytime you want.
I might just scurry on down and be a problem in the front row. And you have no idea. Okay. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to be right back. With the oil and gas guys, we're talking about gascrisis.org, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Leaving home out on the road, I've been down before. Riding along on this big old jet plane, I've been thinking about my home. But my love life seems so far away, and I feel like it's all been done. Somebody's trying to make me stay, you know I've got to be moving on. Oh, big old jet airline, don't carry me too far away.
Everything's a mess. if only they would stay. So, all right, you can't make companies produce, you know, I mean, yet. I think they'd like to do that. But they can't make them stay here. So in a free market economy where you're crushing your industry and you happen to live in California and you're going to run out of gas, jet fuel, propane, diesel, all of the above. People have all sorts of ideas, right? Like train, buses, I don't know, trucks. Why is that not going to work? Who wants to hit that one? Do I have to do
it? Well, California, there's a couple different things going on with California. One, we're geographically dispersed. You know, unlike an East Coast city or Chicago or even Dallas, we don't really have, we have San Francisco, but other cities such as Los Angeles, where I live, we don't really have a central business district. We have more of a dispersed population, dispersed commerce, dispersed business district. So, it's not, it's not feasible to have, at least now, a public transportation system that would go to all the places that people would normally go to. You have that issue. You have the issue of safety on the public transportation system. I do believe there was a point in time where the Barrier Rapid Transit System, BART, stopped reporting some of the criminal, some of the crime on BART because it was detrimental to ridership and things like that. So these are valid concerns that people have when they think about using public transportation. Plus, there's the cost. So, you know, these are all, you know, very valid concerns, and they're hard to address. I think when it comes to the California High-Speed Rail Project, for me, I would love to have somebody have the authority under oath and ask them, you know, very simple questions like, can you go to Union Station in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, and get on the high-speed rail and take it and get off in downtown San Francisco? I'd like to hear under oath the answer to that question. I would also like to hear under oath the answer to the question is, you know, will you ever achieve the 200 miles an hour that you said you were going to achieve, or the 3.5-hour trip from L.A. to San Francisco that you said you were going to achieve? Some of the original representations that were made about that project, I would like to see those revisited and have people come back under oath and answer them for the taxpayers and for the policymakers.
Yeah, I'd just like to know where all the money went, because they haven't built anything, and they've spent, what was it?
I don't know.
200,
it's a lot.
200 million or?
Oh, no, no, it's way north of that.
13 billion?
Oh, no, it's way north of that.
Yeah, I was going to say, way north of that.
It's a crazy amount of money, and they haven't built anything.
Well, I'd like to address another issue. We hear about sustainable fuels and sustainable jet fuels, and so what they do is they take trap grease and they, through the catalytic process and a similar refining process, they actually make jet fuel. But nobody really accounts into consideration, oh, we're using extra natural gas and we're using extra mileage on trucks to get to the refining place. And by the way, the refining place is losing money because they can't get the money they need. And then you take in Bakersfield, for example, we have Bakersfield Renewable Fuels. They're railing in from the Midwest, Iowa, soy oil, so we can refine it into jet fuel. None of this makes, you know, those are great ideas. And sustainable green is fine. But if fact remains, it doesn't make up, Professor, you'd know this, what percentage of our actual jet fuel comes from sustainable renewables. It's probably 1%.
It's minuscule. It is. And keep in mind, they're also talking about AB30, which is ethanol, all right? And that's coming in from the Midwest on trains. And also from Brazil. Now, imports from Brazil have fallen, but I'd like to note that we know that Brazil has destroyed 24 million acres of rainforest to create agricultural zones for the production of sugar cane, for sugar, and sugar cane is used for ethanol, and that's what's exported to California. So, and not all cars will burn E15 product, and so getting this unbelievable 20 cents a gallon difference from ethanol as claimed by the governor is fantasy.
So sustainable, renewable fuels are fine, and that's nice. But if you do what's called a carbon intensity, there's a carbon intensity where they add up all the emissions from fuels and crude coming in from out of the country, and you take and California's carbon intensity, we're like 40, 50. On a carbon intensity, and everything coming in from out of the country is 85, 90. Professor, you correct me on those numbers. But so we put out the cleanest oil and gas in the world. Greenies, get off our back and let us operate.
Yeah.
So the data is there. The problem is, you have a narrative, and people bought into that narrative. They voted for that narrative. And they have to live with the consequences of that narrative. And so it's very difficult for them to come back. And of course, now the easy thing is to point to Trump. Well, you know, Trump is going to be the answer to California's problems. You know, Trump is not the source of California's problems.
Yeah, big difference.
So we're trapped in, like, this bizarre narrative of fiction that has us hamstrung and is getting ready to destroy the world. And yet, kind of like Thelma and Louise, we're just going to, you know, mash the gas pedal and hope we enjoy the wind in our hair, I guess.
We need to intervene. Part of the premise of the supremacy clause was for a situation like this. You know, it's part of the reason why the supremacy clause is ever done. Just something like this that's going on. You know, going back to the jet fuel and everything, those refineries go down, and pretty much every damn airport and base we have in the state will have hard, very, very, very little jet fuel produced. Same thing with diesel. You got a couple of renewable diesel refineries, but we're gonna lose 3 or 4 million, probably about 4 million gallons a day of diesel is gonna go down along with the gasoline. So it's a whole encompassing problem here. Trucks, anything getting food to cities, the whole nine yards. Farmers, emergency equipment, ambulances, fire trucks, all of them that use fuel will be like 85% importing of all of our fuel. That can't be done.
Yeah, it can't be done. And so if these four, if we were left with three refineries, just say, for fun, let's say Chevron says, look, you know, we're sick of it. PBF's like, all right, we're all done. These guys are just fiddling around. And they actually do close down. What does that look like? Practical
disaster.
It's catastrophic. It really is. I mean, you've lost 70. If they close down, as I said earlier, and I did the calculation this morning, you'll lose 76% of all in-state gasoline refinery capacity. And from 2023 to 2020, whenever they close down. Now, if you lose 76%, you do not have sufficient infrastructure to make that up with maritime imports or rail imports. The infrastructure just simply isn't there without massive capital investment. And you're talking billions of dollars and years to build out.
It's time.
That's a major problem. The other major problem that you have is, tankers. Not every tanker wants to come to California. And there's a finite number of tankers available in the world, about 7,000. And I just did the rates yesterday. And so I could, and let me look them up here. So I did the rates yesterday. So a tanker that would have cost us about $130,000 to per day for 2 million barrels of oil.
Wow.
Holy cow.
It's now costing $400,000 a day.
Wow.
Ruh-ruh.
So it's tripled, right? And so that will be reflected, either way, that will be reflected in the cost of gasoline in the coming weeks in California.
But that's not just the gasoline at the pump. That's food prices. That's everything. Everything that's we correct. Get is connected to fuel.
There's an exceptionally strong correlation between what's called the crude price index and the food price index. And when you look at them, they are literally married at the hip, and they move exactly the same way in respect to exactly the same levels of velocity across the years. So when these gasoline prices go up or the crude prices go up, food prices are going to go up. And I think I mentioned to Stan the other day when I was talking to him Friday night, I noticed more tankers on the road, gasoline tankers on the road, than I've ever seen on any Friday night in 30 years living in California, taking the same road home. So two things are happening. They're scrambling to make their deliveries, and probably gas station owners are topping off their storage tanks.
Professor, you said
Professor said it best when he said, our oil and gas production and refining in the state is 8% of our GDP, but he said it's the first 8%. Yeah. And that couldn't be more well said.
Yeah, because without that, the rest doesn't follow.
And on top of that, we were importing 4% of our crude oil. Now we're importing 70% of our crude oil. Professor, correct me if I'm wrong, but this volatility in the oil pricing, the Brent pricing, it's going to have more of an effect on us because of how dependent we are now on imports of crude oil.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, fortunately, most of our crude oil now, about 60% of our crude oil is coming from, actually 48% is coming from South America. 30% came from the Middle East. So we you know.
Is that that's nationwide?
A third.
That's California.
Okay.
Now the U.S., so California is three times more dependent on Middle Eastern oil than the U.S. The U.S. gets about 10% of its oil from the Middle East. California last year got about 30% of its oil from the Middle East. So we'll be scrambling to make that crude up, probably from South America. But then again, now you have the tankers, and you have an issue with the Panama Canal and the number of tankers that you're going to let through the Panama Canal and into it at any one point in time. Remember, the Panama Canal has significant national security implications. So you're not going to allow that canal to get flooded with tankers just because California doesn't have the appropriate fuel policy in place.
Such a nice way of putting it. The appropriate fuel policy in place sounds so much better than, you know, they...
Sounds like California better take care of business.
They signed up just for the rubber room. Yeah.
Saying things we can't say on the radio.
Things we can't say. I know, everybody mute yourselves. Yeah, we need one of those, you know, what they do with you know, people, they put them in a room and let them all hit each other with big rubber bats. I think we're gonna have to maybe do that a little bit. I'll buy the helmets.
No, it's a really, really tough situation the state got itself into, and you know, us three, and then also some of the work I've done with James Rector out of University of Berkeley, California at Berkeley. You know, we said, look, you got to keep these pipelines open, and you have to bring in offshore production. And you're going to have to do something to provide relief to the refiners, because you can't keep beating them over the head, because sooner or later, somebody's going to say, why am I here?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I want to break up with you.
Yeah, I mean, sooner or later, I'm going to pull the plug and I'm going to take my credit card and go someplace else. And that's what we're starting to see. It's reached the breaking point. Now the question is, will the California legislature, doubtful that the governor can do it, but can the California legislature, will they have the wherewithal to confront the situation and take it on with some degree of reasonableness? That remains to be seen. But we do know that President Trump is looking at it very closely and is thinking about different options that may be available to the federal government to provide ease to the California consumer. So we'll see what happens over these next, I would say, 45 days are going to be the most critical. Because keep in mind, what's going to happen over the next 45 days is you have the conversion to the summer blend. That adds at least 15, 20 cents a gallon to the price of gas. You have constraints on supply that we're starting to see, not only coming from the Middle East, but also for the tankers. That's going to create more stress on supply, and we have an increase in chartering rates, three times as much as they were just 2 weeks ago. That's going to be reflected in the retail price of gasoline as it comes into the state. And, of course, you have the automatic increase in the state excise tax that's occurring on July 1st. So we're looking at a significant series of events that will increase the price of gasoline for the average California consumer, period. It's inevitable. So the question is, will the legislatures do something about it, or will they defer and President Trump will have to do something about it?
Yeah. And can you imagine? They would be forced, just based on kind of the way they view the world, to push back on that, which would be kind of interesting. And I'm kind of reminded of this cartoon I saw, and it was a big chicken, and he was wearing a chef hat and an apron, and he's standing there outside the oven with a peg leg, gnawing on a chicken leg. And he's like, wow, I guess we really are delicious. might have to change our state emblem there. Good Lord. Well, let's take a quick break. I have a terrific song for this is the one we hope that the Final Refinery guys are not playing secretly through their Muzak at their plants. I hope they're not hearing this song, but I kind of think they might be. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I'm free. I'm free. And freedom takes on reality. I'm free.
Your own promo during your own show.
Yeah, who set that up?
You're so vain.
Oh my
Get
God.
Get it? Ba-doom, boom, Claudia Simon.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, so I'm kind of hoping that the refineries aren't all secretly hearing the siren song of I'm free. I mean, you can't make them stay here. I mean, do you think if they change the policy, they'll stay hoping that that's maintained? Is there a way to make it permanent?
I honestly don't think they're going to, but I just remembered something with the Chevron CEO maybe 5 or 6 months ago when he was commenting that California has been at war with the refineries for 25 years. And even back then, that gentleman was saying that, you know, things in California need to change. So what's the change? Valero shuts down, and they throw them with a $200 million and then growing cap and investment thing that they have to pay. So instead of making things better, they made things far worse. So that's why, I say it again, when I saw Mr. Walsh, he was very intent when he replied right back. He said, are you guys really going to close? Yes. So you got, 6 months ago, Chevron saying, hey, you guys need to change things. This is not tenable. And then instead of changing things, they made things worse.
So they fined them the $200 million for leaving? Or was that?
No, it's the cap and investment. They made addendums. CARB did some addendums where it went up like 400%, I think, on what they have to pay for their, buying carbon credits or whatnot. And by 2030 or 35, that number on PBS letter, they put down what the numbers are, and I think it was something like $320 million they have to come out of their pocket to refine in California and, the other polluting refineries all over the world with the tankers that are sitting there in the bay right now running their engines, running their generators with the smoke to the atmosphere. They don't have to pay a thing. So, instead of improving, which is what the Chevron CEO was saying 5 or 6 months ago, hey, you guys need to work on this. You've been at war with us for 25 years. This needs to make a turn. We can't keep doing this. This is untenable. And then they come back with these addendums. No, we're going to make you pay a hell of a lot more. for this cap and investment. Then, you know, next thing you know, you got PBF and Chevron putting out the letters. So their track record, I'm not very hopeful.
Yeah, it started out in 2021, he said it was $50 million, and by 2035 is projected to be $308 million. So, yeah, how do you make any money with, you know, numbers like that coming at you?
It's not just that. It's all of the emissions to meet CARB and our resources regulations. Those were hundreds of millions. And then you have a turnaround where you have to turn around the refinery, and that's hundreds of millions. And kind of on that note, even from the oil producers, they go out and they drill a well. You know, that well is 20, 25 years, maybe 30. You put in a refinery, you know, you put that in for life. So these investments that these people have put into California were not, it's hard to shut them down. You just can't walk away. And I think the state, honestly, is trying to capitalize on that. It's hard to shut down. Mike Ariza, you can attest to that. You've been working in those refineries. In fact, you might add on to that.
Well, they're hard to shut down, especially there's a whole bunch involved. But, you know, especially if you're going to shut down permanently. That's a whole different story. Their tanks are emptied. All the catalysts they use in conversion, it's gone. They ship all the coke out. The various units, it'll be very, very hard to restart them. Like right now, the Valero, with the condition it's in right now, and the fact that so many of their qualified people are gone, and by the end of the week, most of the rest of them are going to be gone, you're looking at 6 months minimum to restart the refinery. And we didn't even mention the fact that Valero... the professor can talk about this a little more, but Valero in Wilmington, there's a decent chance they're going to end up shutting down too. So we'll be down to two refineries.
Holy cow.
God.
Okay, so this is just my thought on this. The military then gets all the fuel in the state, and the people do not, right? I mean, well, they're people too, but I mean, just for national security purposes. You can't just cut the military off.
That's the problem. There's going to be no fuel in the state. There's going to be virtually no fuel being produced in the state, not even for our own civilian airports. Again, Chevron, Mike Wall said, Richmond produces 60% of SFO. PBF and Martinez produces the other 40%. That's 100%. That means SFO has no jet fuel produced in California. All the rest, San Jose, Oakland, SAC, they're all the same. So there is no jet fuel made in the state of California for our civilian airports, and there's no jet fuel made for our military.
Yeah, and you look at, in light of what's going on overseas right now, the amount of jet fuel they're going through has got to be just astronomical. If anything like that happened closer to home, we'd be in a world of hurt.
Oh, it's a threat to the whole nation. Now, that's the thing people don't understand in our state. This is a threat to the nation. This is a threat, as we wrote on the report, as the professor dubbed, it's a national security impact, just not California. It is
right.
National security.
Yeah, because it takes a lot of jet fuel to keep the military supplied. I mean, a lot.
Take a look at how much we're burning now, and just in the operations over Iran. I mean, it's an incredible amount.
Yeah.
You know, and on a normal day, I think we've said this before to the listeners. On a normal day, Travis burns about 200,000 gallons a day, just keeping the doors open, keeping the gates open to the base up there. You know, today they've got to be burning well over that.
Oh, yeah.
Well over that. Okay.
Sure.
They're providing logistical support. Absolutely,
they're providing logistical support. So, California can sit around and sort of think of itself as being unique in the Golden State and living in a dome. But the point of fact is the flaring that occurs in Iraq, which provided 22% of California's oil, by the way, in 2025, is an environmental you know, is an environmental disaster over there. Okay, it's far greater than anything that occurs in California's oil production or gasoline production in our refineries. So California has to, I think, if it wants to be, it has always viewed itself as a leader, as the state that's out on in front of everybody. Well, fine. You know, if you're in front of everybody, guess what? You have to lead. And now California is sort of in a situation where it's not leading anymore.
No. Well, there'll be we will be we'll have to change our motto. We'll be called the stationary state. Like, can't go anywhere.
Well, it'll be sort of sad to see what happens to California, because sooner or later you begin to implode, right? It's a combination of factors. How many companies have left under Gavin Newsom? Over 200. Population has, we've lost a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives under Gavin Newsom. So I think, you know, how many houses have been built in Pacific Palisades in a year? I think they're up to a whopping 13 homes have been restored and rebuilt and certified for occupancy. So, you know, I think at some point the data has to be recognized rather than just the narrative. And we have to quit looking for a convenient excuse. We have to look internally amongst ourselves and look ourselves in the eye and say, yes, we created this mess, but we can get ourselves out of this mess.
Yeah, it won't be easy to get out of it, but we definitely have the tools and the resources to get out of it. We always have. We had all the resources prior to us shutting everything off. I don't really understand why they can't see that and bring it all back. And we would be the Golden State again.
So,
well, it comes down to an ideology, the greenhouse gas agenda, and when the price of gas goes up, it's Trump's fault.
Yeah. And this is a terrific opportunity in a terrifying way to get right to the precipice and force them all to look over the edge. I mean,
right.
I can't think of anything that's pushed us this far.
No, especially with the letters that just came out.
Yeah.
No, and when you read those letters, you know they're not messing around. I mean, this is an ultimatum, more or less.
Yes. Well, it's an opportune time for them to flex their muscle. They've never been able to flex their muscle. Well, now because Valero went down, and now because of the world stage that we're in, and all of the data that professors put out, guess what? It is an opportune time to flex their muscle, and I would flex it to the max if I were them, because this is their chance.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, I would be surprised to see Marathon join. Hopefully, that would be a good thing if Marathon joined in with their own letter, too.
Well, Mike, what does Marathon produce in that plant? Don't they do a lot of renewables up there, or what's your understanding of what they produce?
They were 170,000 barrels a day of crude, but all I've seen is they're producing like 40,000 renewable diesel, and that's pretty much it. And then their refinery down in Southern California is the biggest one in the state. It's bigger than the Chevron refineries.
Right, but up north they pretty much all renewables up there, right?
It's all renewables. That's why I was saying, Professor, if Valero's down, if BBF goes down, Chevron goes down, there's no jet fuel made in Northern California. No jet fuel, no gasoline. Northern California, zero.
And so what are we considering Northern California? I know that, you know, depending on where you live, they think Monterey's in Northern California.
The Bay Area refineries.
Okay.
The Bay Area, Sacramento.
So Sacramento, you know, North.
Well, Sacramento and the Bay Area, San Francisco, Oakland, all that. That's where the refineries are in Northern California. They're down.
Concord, Richmond, Martinez, Benicia.
Sure. But I mean, so there's, and there never was anything north of that. So all of us who live north of that are
dependent on those refineries.
Our pipeline and your pipeline to Redding, pipeline to Chico, they all come from the Bay Area. Pipeline to Reno comes from the Bay Area, goes through Sacramento.
Yeah. And you know, you see all these diesel trucks, know, 18-wheelers going up and down the freeway delivering everything from food to TVs, all going to get more expensive, and they're going to probably be shortages because those truckers aren't going to come into California if they can't get fuel.
No.
They just won't come.
Well, you can't.
Yeah.
Well, look what we did.
You're right.
California Air Resources Board already did this with forcing all the trucks to change over their catalytic converters and all that stuff.
Right.
We had to make all those changes, and so then a lot of trucks weren't able to haul, so they had all these transfer stations at the border so we could have different trucks haul things across the border. So here we go again. Somehow we survived that one. We jumped the shark on that one, but they may not be able to jump the shark twice.
No, not on this one.
Well, men?
This one's way more difficult, Aaron. Way more difficult.
Yeah, we've got a lot more moving parts.
There's not an easy workaround here, okay? And just simply, blaming it on the president is, completely naive.
Not going to fly.
Naive.
Boys, we've run out of time, but we do have a shout-out to USC on behalf of the professor to close out the hour. So be sure to send out gascrisis.org. Do a lot of reading, watching, and listening. And we will talk to these guys again for an update. You're listening to We the People.